Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Do you appreciate the role of fungus in the world? Perhaps you've never thought about it before, but the remarkable biology of mushrooms and the networks of underground fungus that produce them are important not only to gourmands, but to the ecosystem of the planet. The edible varieties are delicious enough to keep people foraging for things like morels and truffles and candy caps all over the world, and some of the non-edible ones may hold promise for curing disease and boosting immunity. Journalist and food writer Eugenia Bone is co-president of the American Mycological Society. Her new book is called Mycophilia, Revelations from the Weird World of Mushrooms. Eugenia, welcome to Think.
Thank you.
So you hunted mushrooms as a kid as a sort of weekend family activity. What do you remember about those times?
Well, as a child, hunting mushrooms was particularly magical. To be honest, I kind of still feel it today in ripe middle age. But as a child, I wouldn't see any mushrooms, and I'd be slogging through the woods, following my parents around. And then suddenly I'd see one, and it was like a magical event when, within moments, I could see hundreds. Hmm. It's like they appeared. They revealed themselves. And it's a marvelous feeling of conjuring, in a way, that you want to find a mushroom so much that maybe some mushroom spirit or something has allowed them to reveal themselves to you. So yeah. For me, as a kid, it was pretty magical.
The way you describe it, it's almost like looking at one of those pictures that comes into 3D focus if you stare at it long enough.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's a cool analogy, yeah.
So you sort of forgot all about it, or you had other things going on, and then you and your family bought a cabin in Colorado, and you remembered how much fun it can be to forage.
Yes. I was never much of a hiking person because growing up in a half-Italian family, all of our outdoor activities were foraging or food-related. Mm-hmm. My husband is a hiker, so he would take our guests and so on hiking in the mountains, and I would trudge along, pull pines to the left, pull pines to the right. And then one season started to realize that those mountains were covered with Boletus, porcini mushrooms, mm-hmm. big, fat, beautiful specimens that would send a Italian into ecstasy. The Colorado mountains are full of them. And once I realized that was available to me not so far away from our cabin, then I really was into it full speed once again.
What is a mushroom exactly?
A mushroom is the fruiting body of a fungus. It's like, a good analogy is, the fungus is like the apple tree, and the mushroom is like the apple.
Hmm. So do you do any damage to the fungus below if you pick all the mushrooms?
No. I mean, you can be rough, for sure, and you should be careful when you're picking mushrooms to not disturb the fungus below ground or the fungus that's living in dead wood. You just cut the mushroom off at its base and leave the mycelium, when you kick up the forest dust and there's all that white spiderwebby stuff,
yeah,
that's fungus. Leave that alone. It'll continue to produce fruit when the conditions are right, sometimes, maybe indefinitely. I mean, there's fungi that are out there that some scientists think are 7,000 years old.
You know, it's pretty dry for most of the year here in North Texas, but occasionally after a rainstorm, it seems like out of nowhere we will see them. Do they really grow overnight?
Well, the amazing thing about mushrooms, about many mushrooms, and I'm not talking about the ones that are growing on wood that you see year after year in the same place, mm-hmm. those shelf-type fungi, but the mushrooms that pop up seemingly overnight. Well, when those mushrooms are little babies, they have all of their genetic material and all of their cells, all of their chemicals in place when they're the tiniest little nodules. What happens is when it rains, the mycelium, the fungus, supplies that little baby mushroom with water, and it basically swells.
Hmm.
So a mushroom is just like one of those super thin sponges.
Yeah.
When you put water on, they become like gigantic, like a pillow. Well, that's basically what a mushroom is. That's why it's 70% water, even more sometimes.
Yeah, I guess which also explains why the texture changes so much when you put them in a pan and saute them.
Yeah, because you evaporate off that water. It's also why they're very low calories. You can eat a whole lot of mushrooms and you won't get much caloric. I mean, the butter sauce will get you.
So what do they have in them? They have vitamin D and what else?
Well, they have some of the more interesting, I mean, they have a lot of interesting vitamins, but some of the coolest things about them is they have a lot of fiber in them because their cell walls are made of chitin, which is the same stuff that squid beaks and shrimp shells are made from. So it's pretty much, you know, does the job that fiber does when you eat it, kind of does a little rooter on you.
So you don't really digest it, but it's good for you nonetheless.
You can digest it, but it's, you know, like fiber, a lot continues to go through. I mean, if you eat mushrooms raw, you can't digest it. So they can be rough on some people's systems. If someone has a delicate system, then they will have a hard time with raw mushrooms. And some mushrooms you just can't eat raw because they'll make you sick. There's an interesting array of vitamins and minerals, and there's a lot of protein in mushrooms. In fact, it's a really good protein source if you eat enough of them.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
I was, I guess that sort of accounts for the fact that they, I don't eat a lot of meat, and so we'll put those into recipes where other people would put ground beef or chicken or something like that, and they do have that sort of umami flavor. Is that based on the protein?
Yes, that's exactly what it is. It's because it has those complex proteins. It has all the amino acids that you need. Not every species, but, you know, many of them are very effective that way. That's why you feel satisfied and full. And, in fact, there was a study done, and I believe it's still a larger version of that study is going on right now, that is looking at satisfaction, people's feelings of fullness and satisfaction, mm-hmm. meaning they don't want to have a snack later if their meat in their meals is replaced with mushrooms. And the study is, it's just stunning. It's remarkable how full people feel from eating mushrooms, even though the calories are very low.
And biologically, they are in some ways more similar to animals than plants. Explain that.
Yes. Well, they're for a lot of reasons, but I guess on the most elemental level, it's because on the tree of life, plants split off a lot earlier. Well, not that much. You know, this is evolutionary time. So.
Right. We got 4 billion years to work with.
Right. But they split off a lot earlier than mushrooms split off from from animals. Hmm. So mushrooms and animals were on the same evolutionary tree for quite a while. They're both eukaryotic cells. They have this, you know, the mushrooms have the cell walls that are, like I just said, the chitin that's made of the same stuff that you see in animals. There's a genetic material that is aligned to animal genes. There's a bunch of things that mushrooms respire the same way. They breathe oxygen in and carbon out. So, you know, they're pretty, you know, they're still mushrooms. they're definitely, even though they look like they should be closer to related to plants than animals, they're not.
Now, do those gills on the underside of certain mushrooms, are those the respiratory organ?
No. Those are spore-bearing structures.
Mm-hmm.
So the gills have, depending on the type of mushroom it is, they have little different structures that the spore is produced on. And the reason why, you know, there's questions, and, you know, these generalities are just that, right? They're generalities. But basically the mushroom comes up, its cap opens, all of those, the gills, if it's a gilled mushroom, or, you know, whatever the structures are underneath, are full of spore, or the spore develops, and then the wind comes along and blows that spore around. Or the spore is transported by animal vectors. You know, there's various ways, lots and lots of ways, in fact, that mushrooms have evolved to diversify.
I was astonished to read how many kinds of fungi there are on the planet Earth. Lots more than plants or animals, or I guess it rivals insects, right?
Yes, there's 6 times more species of mushrooms than there are plants.
Hmm.
The only the only critter that there's more of, there's more variation, you know, more different species, is insects. That is the most diverse, you know, category of life, of complex life. You know, we're not talking about bacteria, it's a whole other bag, but of the complex life forms, plants, fungi, animals. Number one, insects. Number two, fungi.
So what role do they serve in the broader ecosystem other than giving us good things to eat if we know what to pick?
Oh, boy. They have lots of roles, and many are still mysterious because just finding out they exist in places that that scientists didn't know they existed previously has been a shock in itself. For example, every leaf, every stem of every plant has fungi living between itself.
Wow.
What is it doing there? Mm-hmm. It's evolved. The thinking is the fungi has evolved with the plant. They helped plants evolve on Earth. And one way is this, whatever, the function that the fungi have that are in the leaves, and many have speculated and are, you know, doing the science that's proving it, that that fungi has a defensive role. It's like the immune system for the plant, produces chemicals that keep grazers away or that keep pests away from the plant. So you can sort of see the fungi that live in the leaves, these endophytic fungi they're called, as the immune system for the plant. Then there's fungi that lives on the roots and in the roots of 90% of all plants. In fact, I grew up hearing that the tree roots gathered all of the food out of the soil and fed the tree, mm-hmm. right? As well as photosynthesis providing sugars for the tree. But it turns out that the tree roots are really mainly there to hold the tree in place. It's the fungi living on the roots and in the roots that actually feeds the tree. So the fungi is like a virtual digestive system or stomach for the tree. And in exchange, the tree gives the tree gives up sugars, which feed the fungi.
Are they susceptible or have they been revealed to be susceptible to the changes that we've seen since global warming?
Well, definitely fruiting of mushrooms can have a lot to do with weather and temperature and really so many factors that much of it is unknown, especially for those species that of mushrooms that are produced by fungus living on the living trees.
Mm-hmm.
These fungus that are living on the roots and in the roots of trees, for example, those would be porcini, truffles, chanterelles. That fungi, because it's in a living ecosystem, yeah, seriously affected by temperature changes. So there are some people who are suggesting that the truffle harvest is heading north in Europe.
Hmm. North meaning you'll find them further north, not that you're seeing mm-hmm. a larger number of them.
No, find them further north, that they'll fruit as the weather becomes warmer. And then their zone to the south becomes too hot.
Eugenia Bone is my guest. She's a journalist and food writer, also co-president of the American Mycological Society. Her new book is called Mycophilia, Revelations from the Weird World of Mushrooms. If you'd like to join our conversation, call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can study a variety of topics such as creative writing, human rights, and the arts. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist and food writer Eugenia Bone. She is also co-president of the American Mycological Society and author of the new book Mycophilia, Revelations from the Weird World of Mushrooms. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So, Eugenia, I have picked wild mulberries from trees. I have pulled dandelion greens from the medians between on a major roadway to eat. I would be afraid to go out and forage for mushrooms for fear of poisoning my whole family. How much knowledge do we need to avoid killing ourselves?
Well, it's just one mushroom at a time.
Uh-huh.
So if you could learn one mushroom that grows, you know, frequently, you know, is reliable in your area, That's how it goes. I learn one a year, really. Well, maybe a little bit more now, but it's really important to I think it's really important to learn about mushrooms in nature itself. You know, books are fantastic, but use a regional book because there's so much diversity within a species. Porcini from Colorado looks very different from a porcini in Italy. So it's good to find a regional book and then hook up with your local mycological society, because in the case of our society, the New York Mycological Society, we go out with our sort of guru, Gary Linkoff, and he says, okay, that's a black trumpet. This is how it looks. And then you'll see 10 others, mm-hmm. and you'll see the variations that make identification easier in the long run, because you kind of get to know how they grow, where they grow, and how they look when they're young and mature.
So essentially, I mean, are you often in a place where there are some that look really safe and some that are similar but are in fact very dangerous?
Well, if you're not absolutely positive of your IDs, and a lot of people, you know, mycophagists, people that eat mushrooms, they can get a little overconfident, which mm-hmm. is a quick way to get yourself a diarrhea.
Yeah.
So it can be a problem, because on a tree stump, for example, there might be a poisonous mushroom growing right next to an edible mushroom, and they look quite similar. I always suggest to people that they just learn one or two, and they focus on those at a time, and become familiar with the species. I mean, I really think that if you'd never seen an artichoke and an asparagus before, it might be easy to mix them up, you mm-hmm. know, if you saw a really skinny artichoke or a really fat asparagus down, together. So it's sort of like that. Just one species at a time is the way to go. I think the way to really imprint it on your mind. And try not to get too full of yourself, you know, because that is a slippery slope.
Is there a point at which particular mushrooms are best picked? In other words, do you want the ones that have just emerged and are sort of small, or are they better when they're big?
Well, always fresh, young mushrooms are better because they will have less. There'll be less opportunities for insects to get in them and on them. And sometimes, once a mushroom begins to sporulate, produce its spores, it'll start to really age out fast after that, so it can get a little rotted.
Mm-hmm.
And some mushrooms are just. Let me just back up for a second. It's really best to go for fresh ones and to go to mushrooms that are growing in pristine areas. Like, don't pick mushrooms on mining tailings.
Good advice. <Yeah. laughs> you know, reading the book, I learned a lot of varieties that I had not heard of before. Tell us about the candy cap.
Candy cap is a pretty spectacular little mushroom. It's it grows in Northern California, and it's mycorrhizal, meaning the fungus grows on the roots of various bushes and trees. And it's one of those mushrooms that a lot of people call LBMs, little brown mushrooms.
Mm-hmm.
They can be kind of hard to identify until you get used to picking them. If you pick enough of them and you're with somebody who can help you, then you really can nail it. They have this maple syrup scent, which is one of their defining characteristics. And when you eat them fresh, they're a wonderful, savory, slightly sweet mushroom. But when you dry them and then reconstitute them in water and then make a simple syrup with that water and those candy cap mushrooms, they are redolent with the flavor of maple syrup, to the point where if you work out at the gym the next day, your sweat's going to smell like maple syrup. I mean, it's just really exotic.
So tell us about the New York Mycological Society, which was your first, I suppose, association with a group of people who really loved to do this. These folks are singularly devoted to finding and understanding mushrooms.
Oh, yeah. But all the societies throughout the country are. They're in every state, often numerous societies in a state. They're full of people who are quite kooky and erudite and curious about science, but they also tend to be what I like to call bloated pleasure seekers. And they really like to eat well, and they like to drink wine. And I'd say that it's socializing. There is to a certain extent, but mushroom hunters in general tend, to my eye and experience, tend to be loners. You know, we go out into the woods together, and there's a camaraderie in the hunt, but everybody quickly splits up and searches on their own, and then everyone comes together again to look at the finds, things like that. But they're wonderful. When I first joined the New York Mycological Society, which was started by John Cage in its current incarnation.
The composer, John Cage.
Yes, yes. And it's going to be the 50th anniversary of the society next year, and the 100th anniversary of John Cage. When I first joined, it seemed like most people were retired and older folks. They were a very knowledgeable bunch. But over the years, I've noticed more and more younger people joining. And it's been really, and the club has really grown a lot. So it's kind of, I don't know, I think it's the DIY people, you know, the foraging, that whole generation of people with all the tattoos and piercing, man, they're out in the woods collecting mushrooms with us. It's just fantastic.
Yeah, you have a friend or an associate you've met that you call the mushroom rock star, this guy Tom Volk.
Oh, yeah. Well, he is something, yeah. He is at the University of Wisconsin, and he's just one of the professors that people who are interested in studying mycology gravitate toward. He's very, very good at speaking to non-scientific audiences, as well as communicating with his grad students and doing interesting experiments with them in his lab. But for those of us that are not pursuing an advanced degree in mycology, he's an incredible asset. I think he's just a treasure, national treasure, because he really can communicate the science and the breadth of the science effectively to people who are nervous that they're going to be either bored or confused.
What is the relationship between a mushroom and a truffle?
Well, a truffle is a mushroom. Mm-hmm. It's just one that grows underground. In fact, a truffle is been found is closely related to it's related to a morel, because when you cut a truffle in half and you see all those little squiggly lines inside, that's actually all those little crevices and cups in a morel having pressed together over evolutionary time, and the mushroom just kind of curled in on itself and rolled underground, maybe to protect itself and its, you know, spores and so forth from a fire or some kind of environmental conditions that, you know, maybe it was a survival evolution for the the truffle to go underground. Its spores are spread by animals digging it up. The truffle releases these gases that attract swine and other animals, and then the animals go crazy when they smell it. They dig up the truffle, and then the spores are dispersed.
Now, how does that work when they use, like, pigs to dig up truffles in France? I mean, does the pig get it in its mouth, and then somebody pries it open and takes it out, or do you just sort of see where it really?
Well, yeah, they try to beat the pig to it, but, you know, if a pig gets a truffle in its mouth, it's probably pretty hard to get it out.
Yeah.
The Italian.
I don't want to have that job.
Mario's a truffle hunter, and he hunts with dogs because he's for two reasons. He said with the dog, you can just say, you give me the truffle, I'll give you a piece of kibble, and the dog is totally happy with that.
Mm-hmm.
And the other reason is, he said the Italians think you look stupid hunting with a pig. Anyway, I didn't meet anybody in the United States, and we have a bunch of truffle orchardists here, some very successful ones, But I haven't met any that hunted with pigs. They all hunted with dogs.
I've never held a truffle in my hand. I mean, I don't have that kind of money, I guess. But what are they very heavy and dense? What do they feel like?
They are. They feel like a clod of clay.
Mm-hmm.
They vary in size. You know, some are tremendous. Those are usually auctioned off, you know, for, like, to big shots, you know, in places like Macau casinos and so on. But the ones that usually you would get if you go to a fancy restaurant, like an Italian place where they grate the truffle on top of your pasta, those are usually about the size of, like, a really large gumball or a large marble. They're dense. They're dense clods of fungal matter.
And they can taste really different depending on, obviously, the variety, but also where they've grown.
Well, different species grow in different places, and their flavors vary species to species. And because they are mycorrhizal, because the truffle lives in association with a living tree, it's really hard to grow them. So it's kind of hard to say what circumstances need to be met outside of their natural habitat. That said, there's truffles growing in Oregon that are unique to that region of the United States. There's truffles that grow in desert sands in the Mideast, and they have a different and specific flavor. Then, of course, the white truffle, you know, there's lots that don't taste like anything and some that taste just perfectly awful.
And truffle oil is probably not worth the money we're spending on it.
I'm sorry to say. But, you know, yeah, it's a ripoff for sure,
mm-hmm.
because it's like a food additive. It's a synthetic chemical that's added to olive oil to create that flavor. It imitates one of the volatile chemicals that create the smell of truffle. There's a few chemicals involved in a truffle, and so when you eat it very fresh, you get this much more complex, you know, deep flavor experience. Truffle oil is a flatter truffle experience because it's just imitating that one chemical.
So you're better off with garlic or oil or something.
Pardon me?
You're better off with garlic oil or something more natural.
Well, you know, there's nothing wrong with truffle oil. It's just what's wrong with it is the price,
mm-hmm.
because you're not paying for natural truffles, real truffles. You're just paying for a synthesized chemical that imitates it. I have no problem. You want to, you know, eat the chemical. That's, you know, it's not going to hurt you or anything. It's just paying a fortune for something that you think is something else that bums me out.
Is there anything biological that's been determined to explain why some people really love mushrooms of all kinds and other people just cannot get far enough away from them?
You know, I had never heard of anything that says why some people are mycophilic and others are mycophobic, mm-hmm. in terms of their eating habits beyond just traditional or cultural differences. The English have a reputation for being mycophobic, and so we actually have a more mycophobic attitude here in the U.S., although that is really changing fast. The Eastern Europeans are more mycophilic. They love mushrooms. The Italians and the French, mycophilic. The Chinese are mycophilic. So, long-standing cultural prejudices, I think that's probably where it comes from. Personal aversion, I don't know. I don't like melon. Can you imagine someone who doesn't like cantaloupe, but it exists?
Okay, so we know that there are people who maybe don't make their entire living, but earn money going out and foraging for mushrooms to sell to other people. Can you tell us a little bit about this crowd?
Yes, it's a really interesting group. It's like it's almost like a gypsy-like culture, although they have home bases. A lot of the people, from my surveys, there's about 1,000 people who are regularly on the mushroom circuit hunting mushrooms. They tend to have home bases in the mushroom-heavy states like Oregon, Washington, California. And what they do is they follow the blooming of wild mushrooms in the West, because once you start getting east, there's not as much public property that they can hunt on. everything's owned. Mm-hmm. So out west in the parks, the states and national parks where they go and get licenses and they hunt the mushrooms, that's their main territory, and they go up into Canada as well.
And we have an email here from Richard in Burleson who wants to know, where could I submit photos of fungi for identification?
Well, the best thing he should do is hook up with his local mycological society. There almost always is a guru of some sort, you know, a scientist who can ID mushrooms for the group. Sometimes, like, we have a Facebook page and people post pictures.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of other groups have Facebook pages, too, and then you just put it up and everybody starts to say, oh, it's a Lepiotis, blah, blah, blah. Binobles are flying. But it can be a great sort of dialogue if you're really interested in identifying species. But, yeah, he needs to find out. And one place he can go to find out what clubs are available to him in his state is there's this website called MycoWeb, MYKOWEB, that has up-to-date listings and contact information for all of the mycological societies in the United States and Canada.
And there are people who collect them without the intention of eating them, knowing that some of them aren't edible and some are?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, I'd say fully half the people in our club, and a great deal of people who are fascinated with mushrooms are really interested in the science. They are hot to ID mushrooms to try to figure out what they are because there's so many that haven't even been identified. A fungi mushrooms, you know, usually I think they're pretty much all identified, but there's a lot of little tiny ones that haven't been named, like something like 95%.
Wow.
Haven't been named or identified or separated out. So I think it's the excitement of this mysterious world that turns on these scientifically minded people. They have little magnifying glasses, and so they're always looking at spore structures and gills and colored.
Eugenia Bone is my guest. Her new book is called Mycophilia, Revelations from the Weird World of Mushrooms. We'll be back in a moment. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist, food writer, and co-president of the American Mycological Society, Eugenia Bone. Her new book is called Mycophilia, Revelations from the Weird World of Mushrooms. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or via email to think@kera.org. I will confess, Eugenia, that when we were pitched this book, I said yes almost right away, in part because I've always been curious about how mushrooms are commercially cultivated. Can you talk about that?
Ah, yes. More and more mushrooms are coming on the cultivation scene. As I bet you've been to your grocery store, it's not just white buttons anymore, right? So that is because all the mushrooms you see in your grocery store are called saprophytes. What they do is they live on dead matter versus the mushrooms that you can only collect in the wild that live on living trees.
Mm-hmm.
So you can grow just about any mushroom that grows on dead matter, that you just can recreate that preferred food and inoculate it with selected spore. In the case of white button mushrooms, those spores are selected for whiteness. In the case of cremini mushrooms, it's just the same mushroom as the white button. It's just not selected for whiteness.
I did not know that.
And in the case of portobello, that's just a cremini that's grown up.
Wow.
It's mature. They're all the same species, all three.
Huh.
So those choices are made by the growers. There's actually sort of two sides to the business. There's the folks that produce the spawn or the spores that have been germinated. They sell that to the growers, and then the growers sprinkle that germinated spore called spawn, or mix it in with compost of various sorts, wood chips, whatever the specific cultivar likes best. Wood chips for some, like, you know, the shiitake likes one kind of thing, the maitake likes another, all the different mushrooms. And then they grow them out in the equivalent of greenhouses. But they don't need sunlight because mushrooms, they don't photosynthesize. They don't need light to grow.
So you actually tried this at home, right? You got sort of a kit?
Oh, yes. This is a staple of the foray and festival scene for mushrooms. You go to join the foray, and then there'll be a class on mushroom growing. And usually it's oyster mushrooms, which are super easy to grow. And you combine like hot sterile straw with this oyster spawn, and then pack into a baggie and stab holes all over it, and then water it, and it'll grow mushrooms. In my case, the mushrooms started out really nice. I had some quarter-sized oyster mushrooms. I was quite pleased. You know, we love those home projects. But then they started to get very warped and strange-looking. They kind of twisted in on themselves. And I really, I wasn't sure why. You know, the conditions were wrong, or I was watering it wrong, or maybe it was because the cat became kind of infatuated with the log and kept rubbing on it and stuff. But eventually it just became like a giant dead insect. It was like more animal and vegetable, and I had to dispose of it.
It was freaking out your kids, right?
Oh, yeah. Well, they're teenagers. They're freaked out by everything. You know, they're embarrassed by everything I do.
We have an email here from Mickey, who goes to France a lot and buys fresh truffles. And Mickey has noticed that they deteriorate, the powerful flavor degrades rapidly, so that by the time we get back to the States after buying them in France, they've lost their vibrancy. Mickey wants to know, is there any way to preserve them, like vacuum packing or freezing?
Yeah, he's out of luck, unfortunately. It takes about, the truffle produces those volatile gases. It's the gas that makes the truffle tastes so great. No gas, and it just doesn't really taste like much of anything. The truffle produces those volatile gases for about 4 days. It's the four-day window of opportunity when the animal is supposed to dig it up and spread the spore. So if you're not eating a truffle within 4 days of its uncovering, of its unearthing, then it's not going to taste like too much, and there's nothing you can do. They're volatile. They are all about, you know, getting out of the truffle and attracting animals and attracting their vectors, the spore, you know, the dispersal vectors. Maybe put them in eggs, and you can maybe put it in flour and things like that. But the downside of that is as soon as you add heat to the truffle or to anything that you've been using as a capture vehicle for the truffle's aroma, once it hits heat, then it disperses even more and totally.
So if you get your hands on one, enjoy it right in the moment and just be satisfied.
Right. Don't save a truffle for a special occasion. When you get the truffle, that's the special occasion. As long as it smells good and strong. I mean, these are the truffles of the Perigords and the white truffles of Italy. I mean, those are the numero uno truffles. But there's great ones here in the United States too. Might be a little less of a trip to get to them than to get to Alba in November.
Speaking of trips, no book called Mycophilia would be complete without a chapter on shrooms.
Yes.
And you actually tried one for the sake of science. You don't strike me as a habitual drug user, but talk about your experiment with this.
Well, you know, I was very anxious about it. I had decided quite a while, maybe a year before, that I wanted to try them. I was curious, but I kept putting it off because I was just. The whole thing about losing control, I mean, it just made me so nervous. I can't even tell you. But eventually, the time was ripe, and I went ahead and I ate some dried psilocybe caps. And it was a very timid approach. It's very hard to dose yourself with psilocybe mushrooms because remember when we were talking about how a mushroom expands because it gets wet,
yeah,
like a sponge? Well, that means that the baby has as much, has all the chemicals and all of the cells and so on as a mature mushroom.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're dosing yourself by the weight of the mushroom, then all of those, and it's all babies, then you're going to take way, way more, you're going to get way, way more psilocybin, which is the active component in the mushroom.
Yeah.
So I was very nervous about all of that. But I ended up taking them. And what happens is that when you take the mushroom, the psilocybin in the mushroom, it's what causes a blue staining in it. It when you metabolize it, it turns into something called psilocin. And psilocin either mimics or amps up serotonin, mm-hmm, production in the brain.
So you just feel groovy and great.
You feel it's more of a it's almost like the senses, my senses, and I think it varies depending on doses and stuff, but all the senses were turned up to like 11.
Uh-huh.
You know what I mean? My sight was much more, was beyond 20/20. I could see more sights. I could smell more variety of smells. There was a certain kind of respiring of the earth that I had never sensed before.
Hmm.
Colors were more vibrant, and these were all like the mild kind of symptoms. I mean, people who take large doses can have what's called, what they're like waking dreams that are, I think, very intense but very dissociating, and definitely one's judgment is off, because I thought, oh, I'm going to walk down the mountain. It's the town is just right down there. I can see everything really clearly. And so I started trucking down that mountain. And, you know, in retrospect, it might have taken me like 4 days or something. So, you know, it's a little bit of that Alice in Wonderland thing where some things seem really big and some things seem really small.
Yeah.
But there is that other aspect of serotonin or the receptors in your brain that's touched by serotonin. And there's some studies going on at Johns Hopkins University that are really super interesting about how there seems to be a subreceptor or whatever, maybe a subreceptor on a subreceptor and so on, that when activated or stimulated by psilocin creates a sense of religious ecstasy, which suggests that there's actually a place in the brain where God or feelings about spiritual feelings reside, just like you might have a latent ability to smell more smells. When activated, you can do it. So this study has been going on. This fellow's name is Griffiths, who is looking into the idea of the God within, which is actually a phrase that was used by the Aztecs and other Central American Indian peoples who took the mushroom for religious purposes.
Yeah, I just read recently a theory that the Salem witch hysteria might in fact have been caused in part by contamination by some kind of fungus.
Yes, ergot.
Yeah.
Which grows on grasses, wheat and rye and so on. That stuff's nasty. That's St. Anthony's fire. You know, there's two kinds. There's convulsive and
convulsive
gangrenous.
Sounds bad enough. Goodness.
Yeah, they're nasty. Anyway, it's like a really, really bad trip with pieces of your body falling off at the same time.
Wow.
And so it makes sense because the temperature conditions and so on are considered by the anthropologist who came up with that theory. You know, she figured out that this could very well have been what happened to the people of Salem. It's happened in France as recently as the 50s, and of course St. Anthony's Fire was a plague of the Middle Ages. But ergot is a pathogen of wheat and grains and grass and so on, and ergot is what ergot is what LSD is synthesized from. So it's a it hits your dopamine receptors, and it's different from psilocybin mushrooms. It's kind of a whole different game. But similarly, it also affects serotonin receptors, so you can have a feeling of seeing the meaning of life in small everyday objects, you know, that kind of phenomena.
So with all these powerful neurotoxins in different mushrooms, it stands to reason that there could be things in them that, that can cure what ails us.
Excuse me? This could be things in them
it
that
could
can
be
what?
Things that can cure what ails us, medical yes. applications.
Absolutely. Cluster headaches, migraines. There's a, you know, in the right dosage, it can be, you know, fantastic medicines. I mean, poisons are can be medicines, too. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, ergot has been used for that kind of thing. And psilocybin is being looked at to help people with cluster headaches and neurological disorders of various sorts, stuttering and things like that. And then, of course, mushrooms and medicine has this ancient history, you know, many years of it.
It's sort of amazing that our ancestors kept eating them, given that some of them are great and some of them can, you know, kill you in 24 hours.
Well, you know, they learned. Just like there's a lot of wives' tales out there, you know, that are not very sensible, like if it grows on trees, it's not poisonous, which is not true.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, you know, oral tradition, if you have the same environment, where people are picking the same mushroom generation after generation. Oh, this chaga, is this good if you've got, you know, a stomach ailment? So generations of people use the simple cures. You know, that's fading out, and environmental change can disrupt the validity of some of those simple cures, you know, because they're affecting the organism itself. Yeah, I mean, it's where all our medicine comes from. I mean, penicillin was, people were doing it when they, you know, about 200 years ago, and get a cut on your leg, someone slap on a piece of moldy bread. Yeah, and now we have penicillin and antibiotics and all that business, but it's the same. Just a more refined, I mean, we just know what we're dealing with now.
So in the few seconds we have left, obviously it's ideal to eat mushrooms the moment you get them home. How long do they keep if you can't do that? A day or two?
Well, if they're very young and fresh, you can put them in the fridge without washing them first,
mm-hmm.
In a paper bag where they can breathe, and they'll hold for a few days, no problem. They just don't, you just don't want them to get really moist, and you don't want them to get too warm, and they will dry out eventually, too. So treat them like flowers
mm-hmm.
or fruits. That's what they are.
The new book by Eugenia Bone is called Mycophilia, Revelations from the Weird World of Mushrooms. Eugenia, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure for me, too.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
The Think production team includes engineer Nilufer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.